loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. I'm usually joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou, but John is traveling this week. We'll have guest hosts. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. Donald Trump, contrary to expectations, did not impose new economic sanctions on Russia. He decided to postpone that decision. We're going to talk about what motivated Donald Trump. What's his relationship with UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who promised that there would be new sanctions, and where the administration is going big picture with U.S. relations with Russia. In our second story, we take a look, as we do every Tuesday, on the big economic issues of the day. We are joined once again by financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is visiting Trump and Mar-a-Lago today. Both leaders are dealing with scandals, and Abe's approval ratings are in the 30s or even 20s, according to one opinion poll. How will the visit affect the Trans-Pacific Partnership, high-level diplomacy in Korea, and other key global issues? Next, debate is raging in the British Parliament over the highly unpopular decision by Theresa May's government to join the US-led missile attack on Syria last Friday. Opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn is pushing for a War Powers Act to limit the ability of a prime minister from launching military action in the future without consulting Parliament. Then, a series of deadly attacks across Afghanistan, the government says was carried out by the Taliban, took place over the weekend, leading to dozens of deaths as the spring fighting season gets underway. Will the U.S. occupation of the country ever end? And then, a federal court ruled recently against a 2017 Maryland law that let the Attorney General sue pharmaceutical corporations for price gouging. Is this another case of corporate profits coming before people's needs? And finally, David S. Bakel was a prominent LGBTQ rights lawyer who litigated landmark cases for marriage equality and the rights of LGBTQ youth. Later on, he fiercely advocated for protections for the environment. He died on Saturday after setting himself on fire in a tragic act of protest against climate change. And in other headlines, today is Palestinian Prisoners' Day, the annual observance honoring the sacrifice of Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. 6,500 Palestinians are currently held in Israeli prisons, including 350 children and 500 people who are being indefinitely detained without charges, so-called administrative detention. Thousands took part in demonstrations today, which were attacked by Israeli forces, firing rubber bullets and tear gas. Conflicting reports are circulating regarding a suspected Israeli airstrike that is alleged to have hit the Shayrat airbase in Syria last night. The apparent false alarm took place at the same airbase that was hit in last year's U.S. attack. Taxes are due today in the United States, but the IRS website crashed at perhaps the worst moment possible. Up to 30 million taxpayers could be affected by today's website crash. Acting IRS Commissioner David Cowder said that the crash was most likely the result of a breakdown in IRS systems and not the consequence of a hacking operation. Outrage continues over the arrest of two black men in a Philadelphia Starbucks who were racially profiled while waiting for a friend to arrive. Starbucks announced today that they would close all 8,000 company-owned stores in the United States for one afternoon to conduct what the CEO called racial bias training. Activists in Philadelphia and across the country have been organizing demonstrations and calling for a boycott of the corporation. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion about the debate within the Trump administration over new sanctions on Russia.
Loud and clear.
But first, we turn to the issue of possible new U.S. economic sanctions against Russia. Despite Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley's announcement that there would be additional sanctions on Russia imposed yesterday, Donald Trump pulled back. Whether a misstep by Haley or indecision by Trump, the office is clearly not organized. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. Jim and Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Jim Kavanaugh, of course, the New York Times and the Washington Post are so disappointed, purportedly. Donald Trump didn't go forward with what Nikki Haley said was the inevitable, the imposition of even new, even more imposing and more draconian sanctions on Russia. Anyway, why do you think he's put the brakes on?
Yeah, well, it seems that Trump feels he's been sandbagged by the permanent government or deep state or whatever we want to call it, which is pushing for more aggression against Russia than he initially wanted. And apparently he was very angry about the expulsion of 60 Russian diplomats, which he thought was going to be matched by European countries, and wasn't. The same numbers weren't. He wanted to be not in the lead on that, apparently. He was very angry about that. But what it's going to show you is that Trump is not in control in the way that he thinks he is. You know, as any American president discovers, there is an apparatus that has its own momentum and works very hard, and it consists of people who've been in the government for many years and in quasi-governmental institutions, and they push policies that they want. And Trump is out of his depth on this. He thinks he's the top dog, and he's far from it.
Yeah, I think those are good points. Daniel Lazar, we're looking at the Washington Post, and I'll read a couple sentences to you and then get your reaction. President Trump seemed distracted in March as his aides briefed him at his Mar-a-Lago resort on the administration's plan to expel 60 Russian diplomats and suspected spies. The United States, they explained, would be ousting roughly the same number of Russians as its European allies, part of a coordinated move to punish Moscow for the, quote, poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter on British soil. Quote, we'll match their numbers, Trump instructed, according to senior officials. We're not taking the lead. We're matching. The next day, when the expulsions were announced publicly, Trump erupted, officials said. To his shock and dismay, France and Germany were each expelling only 4 Russian officials, far fewer than the 60 his administration decided on. Daniel Lazar, what they're sort of suggesting is he wasn't listening. The aides were saying it's the total in aggregate of all that Europe will be expelling. Clearly, how could the president of the United States be that wrong about the intentions of his own administration? Is it just a matter of distraction, or were they in fact pulling the wool over his eyes?
I think it's the latter to a certain extent. You know, that same article in the Washington Post also quoted Trump as saying in response to Jim Mattis's lobbying efforts, I just want peace. I mean, so Trump is in his own confused, backwards, you know, way, is trying to establish a rapprochement with Russia. And that is what the deep state or the permanent government or whatever we want to call it fears most. All of Washington, all of the corporate media is infected by a first-class case of war fever, and they are pushing for a confrontation, and Trump is being dragged along. I mean, Trump came into office as the rapprochement candidate. He was the one who wanted to strike a better relationship with Putin, and now he finds himself befuddled, crippled, blocked, you know, besieged on every side. I don't want to make Trump into a good guy, because the guy is, you know, we all know his faults. They are manifold. But what's happening here is he finds himself up against this permanent apparatus, which is thirsting for a confrontation with Moscow.
Well, let's talk about the role of UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, Jim Kavanaugh. I mean, how could she be that out in front? I mean, she said on Sunday that the Trump administration will announce additional sanctions against Russia soon. And then at least all the news reports were that soon meant tomorrow, meant yesterday. Where is Nikki Haley? Is she working with some other people in the professional government? Are they signaling things in a coordinated way? Or was she just sort of a rogue element here, really sort of promoting her own agenda, her hardline hawkish agenda, which of course she is. But what's your take on that?
Well, we can't know too specifically, but, you know, these policy decisions are usually made by within the State Department or within the National Security Agency by the leaders and mid-level officials there. And then they're comfortable with their relationship and they're speaking and they know what the president wants. In this case, you don't have that. So Nikki Haley can be talking to John Bolton. I mean, this is a cult classic, Bolton Haley. Trump has appointed these people. This is the problem with, you know, his own contradictions, as Dan is saying. He might have wanted to come in as a man who wanted peace, but he's appointing all these people who are never going to let that happen. So Nikki Haley can be talking to John Bolton and other NSA people and other national security and intelligence people. And they're saying, okay, this is the next thing we're going to do. And just presuming they're going to get Trump to go along with them, which they probably will at the end of the day. So, you know, it does show the chaos in the administration. And also it reflects the lack of precision and the contradictions within Trump himself, I think.
Daniel, just a few days ago, of course, Donald Trump sent, you know, more than, I don't know how many the U.S. toll included, but maybe 90, 100, more than 100 cruise missiles were sent crashing into Syria. And at that time, and the day before that, Trump said to the Russians, get ready. He was sort of taunting Russia, who had said, some of the military people or officials had said that they would shoot down cruise missiles. He said, get ready, Russia. Here comes new, smart, whatever else he said, adjective-wise, missiles, they're coming, get ready. And then he also said Russia is supporting the animal Assad and, you know, saying also that U.S.-Russian relations were at their all-time worst than they were during the Cold War. Now, 3 days later, he says he's not, at least for the moment, imposing new sanctions. And the media is beating him up for not going further, not having dropped more bombs and missiles on Syria, now dragging his feet, as they say it, about more sanctions on Russia. But is Trump here? And I know we don't really know. We don't have clairvoyant capabilities here. But is Trump actually about U.S.-Russian relations right now, or is he just reflecting pique over the fact that he feels misled the last time that he expelled these 60 diplomats?
I think it's the former. I think the one consistent thing that he said from the campaign into his presidency is a desire for a better relationship with Putin, whom he seems to genuinely admire. I think he's a really smart guy, an effective guy. He kind of admires his nationalist politics, and so Trump wants a better relationship. And this very idea is anathema to the permanent state, the deep state, whatever you want to call it. So Trump is struggling. The guy is himself has an incoherent worldview. He's hostile to Iran, but wants to be friendly with Russia, not quite realizing that the Iran and Russia are allies to an extent, and therefore it's impossible to have one without the other. He's very hostile to Assad. It's a great big mess. But the point is that Trump is caught in the spider's web. The more he struggles, the more tightly bound he becomes. And this is, he's now emitting a peep of protest. But I agree with Jim that he'll fall into line soon enough.
Yeah, because Jim, if you look back at everything, the expulsion of large numbers of Russian diplomats, the closing of Russian consulates, the sending of advanced weaponry to Ukraine, obviously to be used against either Russia or people Russia is supporting or who look to Russia for support in the eastern part of the country. That's something that Obama wouldn't do because it was considered such a grave escalation, at least perceived to be such, from Russia, and Russia would take countermeasures. When you put it all together, it's not a Trump-friendly to Russia administration at all. Things have really deteriorated to such a point. And the sanctions or the earlier sanctions, the ones from last week, they've taken a big toll on Russian companies, like on Rusal, the aluminum producer. They lost almost 50% of their value, and the Russian stock market sort of tanked. Maybe it will recover, and there will be a drive for domestic rather than global investment as a consequence. Anyway, talk about that. We have about 3 minutes left.
Yes. I mean, it is completely incoherent, and he is going to be pushed towards more. And I want to say this is the most important thing, toward more military aggression in Syria, because you can't, you know, again, as Dan is saying, he thinks he can be peaceful with Russia, but not with Iran. And he thinks he can get out of Syria, but the Israelis and the Zionists are pushing him in a completely other direction, and they're going to get their way pretty much probably. And these sanctions are bizarrely incoherent themselves, because they are pushing Russian oligarchs and billionaires, whom we created, to bring their money back to Russia. And they're forcing people to kind of acknowledge that Putin is right, that we can't trust the United States. We can't trust the West. We can't do business in the West. And it may be that, for example, Roussel, the Times was talking about this the other day, that Putin will renationalize that. And the percentage of industry which has been nationalized in Russia has been growing because they're learning a lesson that the terms of doing business with the United States are political compliance totally. Otherwise, you're going to get crushed. You're going to have an economic war against you, if not a military war. And this is a kind of bizarre issue. And so there's a possibility that these sanctions are politically, they have strengthened Putin. They've forced people to kind of rally behind him. And there's no place else to go.
Yeah, we have 1 minute left. Daniel Lazar, according to updated figures provided by the U.S. Treasury Department, I'm looking at SputnikNews.com, in February, Russia's hard currency reserves currently held in U.S. treasuries went down by $3.1 billion, now stand at $93.8 billion, the lowest level since March of last year. In other words, even though Russia is the 16th largest holder of U.S. government bonds, it's scaling back on bond purchases because they're anticipating that any interaction right now with the U.S. economy will be used as leverage, really to hurt, not to help the Russian economy. 45 seconds left.
Yeah, I think they're totally correct. I mean, it's a funny thing about free trade. It's free as long as you do America's bidding. But if you fail to do that, then you get walloped. So Putin feels besieged. He's not incorrect, and he's pulling back. He's kind of renationalizing. The oligarchs are going back home. He's probably turning to the east. Remember, the only country that supported him, besides Bolivia, the Security Council the other day in condemning the Syria attack was China. So I think China is worried as well. And I think that we're going to see a strengthening of the Chinese-Russian alliance.
I think you're right. We've been joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we've been joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. In our second segment of this half hour, we're going to listen to a pre-recorded interview that we conducted yesterday with economist Steve Keen and journalist and commentator Dmitry Bobich. Steve Keen is talking to us from London, Dmitry talking to us from Moscow. We were anticipating new U.S. sanctions on Russia, and we were talking about what their projected impact would be on the Russian economy and on Russia's place in global politics. Let's take a listen. Dmitry Bobich, let's start with you. Yesterday, when we were talking about this issue, and of course, everyone was poised yesterday to hear the announcement, the expected announcement of additional sanctions on top of those sanctions already imposed on Russia by the United States and their impact on the Russian economy. Steve Keen was making the point that Russia's economy is about one-tenth of GDP of the United States, that the economic sanctions imposed by the United States may have a profound impact, at least on some parts of the Russian economy, a negative impact. You said yesterday that perhaps it would have just the opposite impact, the unintended consequences being that Russian companies would refocus on the domestic economy rather than functioning in the global arena. Steve was making the point, though, that they're global companies trying to raise global capital to finance their operations. Anyway, Steve was also making the point, Dmitry, that it's really China that's challenging the U.S. domination economically on the global scale because of its rise. The focus on Russia might be misplaced if the concern really is in Washington, not so much about chemical weapons attack, but subverting or inhibiting or obstructing a global rival. Go ahead.
I think that from the economic point of view, the actions of the United States against Russia, they just don't make sense. Because if you look at all of these so-called oligarchs that they sanctioned, none of them ever uttered a single anti-American statement. I mean, there are a lot more anti-American capitalists around the world, you know, people not happy with the United States. These people, you know, these 24 individuals that were targeted by the latest wave of sanctions, they're actually, most of them are pro-Western liberals in their public pronouncements. Their problem is just that they have some kind of a relationship with the Russian government and with President Putin, and that's already an irritating factor for the United States now, which is simply absurd, because show me a rich company, show me a rich individual which has no relation to the government. You can't find such species in today's world, I'm afraid.
But the question, Dmitry, is this. Not that it's logical. These people may not be anti-American at all, but by virtue of the sanctions, it's designed to weaken Russia, weaken the Russian economy. Of course, it's not the Soviet Union. In 6 years, Vladimir Putin will not probably run again for office. There's not a party that's running Russia right now. The question of continuity or lack of continuity certainly is part of the calculations. Steve Keen is making the point, though, that this is actually going to have a very negative impact on the Russian economy. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. You think just the opposite, though.
Absolutely, yes. Well, first, about the figures. Russian economy is just four times smaller than the Chinese economy. That's the general estimate. And yes, I agree with Steve that China is more important economically right now. If you look at the global players, if anyone is interested in globalization, that is China. But it's already clear that there is not going to be one globalization. There are going to be at least three. One centered on the United States and the European Union. The other one centered on China and perhaps Russia as a kind of additional power. And the third one, you know, which will comprise the Pacific nations, which are reluctant to be in the orbit of Chinese influence. So basically, there will be three globalizations. And ultimately, because the United States is trying to disconnect from Russia so desperately, it may have a healthy effect. Well, first, the United States has a very small trade with Russia. It's not mortal for both nations if we stop trading with each other, although I think that would be very unfortunate. Russia has a lot of trade with the European Union, but that trade is not healthy. Russia is mostly supplying oil and gas to the European Union, also some fertilizers, food, you know, but that's not a healthy exchange. So right now, what Russia is interested in is the big companies turning inward and finding new markets, preferably in Southeast Asia, in India, probably in Africa. We already sell a lot of grain to Egypt, for example.
Let me just ask Steve Keen to comment on what you, Dmitry, were saying about three globalizations. I mean, in the 1990s, after the Soviet Union fell, you know, the United States government, the big corporations, the big think tanks were talking about, you know, globalization in the singular, and it was always assumed politically that it would be under the direction of the U.S. government. Steve Keen, what do you think about this idea that now maybe we're looking at three globalizations?
Well, I think we're certainly getting back to global political blocks in a way that, again, rings of not just the pre-First World War period, but it even rings of 1984 with the disinformation that's flowing around. But yes, this might be what's forced upon the corporations, given the degree of chaos that Trump is creating, first of all with tariffs and now with sanctions. In that world, of course, it's companies that produce our goods, and we record the GDP at the national level, but it's corporations that are doing the production. And they're going to be making decisions, much like the one Dmitry said Russians themselves are making, to say, we really can't afford this instability in our supply chains. How do we minimize it? No way to minimize it is to localize the extent to which you globalize. You won't be looking at having supply chains going through China if you're based in Europe as much as you would have beforehand. You might think, let's try some of the, the regional, the eastern extremes of Europe, rather than looking for cheap labor in Asia anymore. So I think it will force a more of a nationalized pattern. It's just a pity this is, I'd prefer more localization, but I don't want to see it in the context of what seems to be a return to great power rivalries.
Yeah, and perhaps as what we could see in before World War One, unrestrained rivalries. I mean, there was a certain equilibrium during the Soviet-U.S. global confrontation, misnamed as the Cold War, but there was, at a certain point, equilibrium, the rules of the road. It was a managed rivalry. This has the appearance of the beginning of an unmanaged rivalry with many unpredictable and perhaps unmanageable elements to it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the situation right now is a lot more dangerous than during the time of the Cold War, and even more dangerous during the most dangerous period of the Cold War, you know, the 50s. If you look at the 50s, you know, the Soviet Union and China, They were the revolutionary powers who wanted to change the world, who wanted the Western countries to change. But they were in the minority, economically, militarily, in every respect. Now we have the majority. We have the powerful nations of the United States and of the European Union basically acting as revolutionary powers, doing what they call regime change, which is in fact a chain of destructive revolutions in the countries like Ukraine, Georgia, Libya, Iraq, lots of them, right? So I think the situation now is a lot more dangerous, because when you have status quo powers in the minority, that makes the world very unstable. And the reason why I talked about three globalizations is if you look at Africa, if you look at Latin America, there are quite a few countries deep inside these continents which are already oriented more towards China than the United States. The Arab countries are selling just about as much oil now to China as they are selling to the European Union and to the United States. There are other nations in the Pacific, like Vietnam, like the Philippines, which are very reluctant to be totally dependent on China, so they can create an axis of their own, I mean, an economic axis. That's why I'm talking about three globalizations. I don't think I quite agree with Steve that this is because of great power rivalries, because initially the post-communist Russian elite and the post-communist Chinese elites, they were very much oriented towards the United States.
Okay, we have 1 minute left. Steve King, go ahead. You get the last word.
Well, to me, it is a huge amount of irrationality in what's happening now. And I quite agree that the Cold War period basically meant that countries were very, very reluctant to move in each other's sphere of influence in the danger, because of the danger of provoking, you know, all our nuclear war. And that's one reason, as I said some time ago, I'd rather have a tripolar world than have a unipolar world with a bipolar president. But that's the world we've fallen into, and we're now seeing this sort of 19th century great power rivalry behavior where they are trying to push into each other's spheres of influence while they still have nuclear weapons. It's an extremely dangerous and frankly stupid pattern. In some ways, I'm longing for the Cold War and mutually assured destruction. It worked better.
Yeah, I agree with you. Dangerous and stupid. We've been joined from Moscow by Dmitry Babich. He is a journalist and commentator with Sputnik International. And we've been joined from Amsterdam by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics. Steve is the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen. That's K-E-E-N. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
Today, we continue our weekly series looking at the top economic issues of the day. We're joined every Tuesday by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst in San Francisco. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Brian.
You know who else is doing good? The Bank of America and all the other banks. I mean, we're looking at a story. They're reaping a whirlwind of profit. Super profits as a consequence of the tax plan. Let's talk about that.
Absolutely. So they certainly are reaping a whirlwind because of the tax plan, not just because of the significantly lower tax rate that they now have to pay, but also because they're allowed to repatriate their funds to the U.S. That is to say, they're able to move it from offshore entities into the U.S. at a much lower tax rate than they would have had to pay previously prior to the GOP tax plan. B of A is one such company that has some of the largest deposits out of nearly any corporation offshore and therefore enjoying kind of tax-free benefits. So what they're going to do is bring a ton of that money home and then use it to buy back their shares, and that will effectively increase their share price. So it's basically a transfer of that wealth offshore into the hands of their shareholders, who will, you know, get huge dividend bonuses and share increases. In addition, on top of all that, they are also experiencing a huge bump in profit because the Fed is raising interest rates and will probably continue to raise interest rates a few more times this year. With higher interest rates, they're able to charge higher amounts on their loans that they make, which is, of course, a huge source of revenue for the bank. And so put that all together, and they're making a tremendous amount of money. It's pretty overwhelming. They also, of course, are paying as a percent far less in taxes than virtually any sort of consumer, and were doing that before, and now get to do that in even more severe degree now that the GOP tax plan is in advance. And it's not just Bank of America, although certainly that's the one that's probably benefiting the most currently, but all the big banks, whether it's Chase or Citi or Wells Fargo, are enjoying a huge boost in profits because of the recent legislation passed.
I want to read a few sentences that go exactly along the lines of what you're talking about from the Wall Street Journal yesterday. Bank of America said Monday that a boost from the U.S. tax law and continued rising interest rates helped push first quarter profits 30% higher, extending the string of better-than-expected results from the nation's biggest banks, not just Bank of America. Quarterly profit at the Charlotte, North Carolina-based bank rose to $6.92 billion from $5.34 billion a year ago. I mean, that's huge. That's a huge increase over last year. And when you think about it, Daniel, we're told over and over again that if the biggest corporations, or in this case, the biggest banks, make extra profits, super profits, that they're going to use those profits to invest in the real economy. And so it won't just be Wall Street. It will also be Main Street that will be the beneficiaries. Everything trickles down. These are the job creators, as we're told over and over and over again. But I don't think there would be any reason for people to put on rose-colored glasses and think that because the Bank of America or the other biggest banks, Wells Fargo, you name it, are making excess profits, super profits, that any of that money is going to trickle down.
That's correct. There's a couple of things to think about. One of the things that I mentioned was the share buybacks, which really just means very simply that a company takes its profits that it's made, for example, that significant profits that B of A just made that you referenced, and they use that money to buy back shares from other shareholders, usually at a very preferred price. And what that does is that increases demand for the shares and reduces the amount of shares that are out there in the marketplace. The end result is the share price goes up. They also use that to do dividend payouts, which basically means that for every share you own of a company, you get a certain amount of money paid out to you per quarter. And so it's just an incentive for you to hold those shares and to buy them. So what both of those things have in common, though, is they're not creating jobs. B of A isn't, building factories or engaging in activity that would suddenly increase jobs. These ways of pushing money around are really just ways to get money, the profits from the bank, into the hands of the largest shareholders, many of which are bank employees at the executive level. Furthermore, I think we see in miniature a sort of general tendency, which is B of A's profits didn't happen because B of A created some amazing new financial instrument or created some kind of new service or good that everybody's wild about and buying. They increased because they stole it from taxpayers, because now they have to pay less into the system. So their profitability isn't really something that's particularly due to talent or expertise or all that.
What do you mean by stole it from the taxpayers? I think you're speaking euphemistically, but what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is they are, prior to the GOP tax plan, paying a particular corporate tax rate, which is then going into the U.S. government. Now, granted, a very large chunk of that goes to the military, but a fair amount goes to social services, goes to taxpayers and such. But if such services are going to continue, then someone's going to have to pay for it. And given the GOP tax cuts, it's not going to be B of A, right? Because they're paying less taxes. So who's going to have to pay for it? Well, people like you and I, the average taxpayers. Taxes are not going to enjoy the same huge decrease. In fact, they're going to go back up to what they were in a few years. So in effect, we're going to have to make up the shortfall that B of A's tax cuts have created. So that's where they're enjoying this huge boost in profits. It's not from something they've created. It's simply from new legislation that reduced their tax rate such a huge amount.
You know, this isn't the first time that the Bank of America has been the beneficiary of a government program. And after the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, as part of TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, Bank of America got about $45 billion of bailout money. Because they got this big bailout, they were able to weather the storm of the crisis better than a lot of the, you know, other big banks that weren't quite as big as Bank of America. So they were able to acquire, you know, former competitors like Countrywide Financial, Merrill Lynch. When you're a bank as big as Bank of America, you really can't lose, right?
That's correct. I mean, I have personal experience from that whole financial crisis. I've been in the financial services industry over a decade. So has my wife, incidentally. And both of us were laid off during that period of time. You know, we were in operational roles that either became redundant as banks grew in size by buying out smaller banks because of the financial crisis, or laid off people because now they couldn't, you know, afford them anymore because they were in such desperate financial situation. The Troubled Asset Relief Program essentially dumped billions of taxpayers' dollars into the pockets of these banks so that they could continue to survive. That's really where this huge amount of super profit from these banks come from. It really comes from the public wealth that we've created, you know, as a society, whether it's them getting a break through the GOP tax legislation, getting a big handout from TARP or something like that. I mean, these are the most powerful institutions in the world, and they're able to maintain that power and that growth simply by, you know, legally sealing it or taking it from the pockets of the people that actually produce the wealth in society.
Daniel, let's turn to a few of the other big economic stories of this week. I'm looking again at the New York Times. It's from today. The byline, the dateline comes from Shanghai, China. China's second largest maker of telecommunications equipment will not be able to use components made in the United States after the Commerce Department said it failed to punish employees who violated American sanctions against Iran and North Korea. And then it goes on, the ban announced Monday, which effectively locks the company ZTE Corporation out of American technology for 7 years, is a blow to one of China's few truly international technology suppliers. And then again, this company produces products for infrastructure of telecommunications networks, as well as smartphones, microprocessors from chip makers, glass made by Corning, sound technology from San Francisco-based Dolby. This is a pretty big deal.
It's a huge deal. I think there's a couple of things in there to point out. The first is around sanctions. So the United States engages in economic warfare with countries that it does not agree with their politics, essentially countries that are not compliant with U.S. demands for profit, U.S. demands for the opening of their markets, countries that essentially want to be concerned with their citizens and their citizens' needs first. So what happened here is they sanctioned countries like North Korea and Iran, who they don't like because they're not opening up their markets to the U.S. and they're insisting on governments that are controlled by their own citizens as opposed to U.S. business interests. And they're telling not only is the U.S. not allowed to do business with these countries, but everyone else isn't allowed to. And if they do, they need to punish their people. They need to bully them. And in this case, China didn't, right? They said, hey, look, you have your sanctions. You have your economic policy. We have ours. We're not going to punish our employees for selling to countries that we are comfortable selling to. And in response, the U.S. is saying, fine, you're not allowed to do business with us at all, which is what happened here. That's a huge form of economic warfare. It cripples countries. It causes starvation. I mean, we could go on and on about it. But additionally, what we're seeing here is the escalation of this trade war between the United States and China, which is really the much bigger, more significant story. We're seeing a huge rollback in decades and decades, really since post-World War II, of U.S. policy, which has been this grand vision to have this completely global capitalist network, this sort of stateless flow of money and commerce anywhere in the world, free from tariffs, free from barriers created by states, so that profit could be sought everywhere and anywhere. And this is a hard turn away from that. And that's what the Trump administration represents. It is a hard turn away from it, where we're now erecting trade barriers and punishing countries and locking them out of our markets as a desperate way for us to hold on to our empire and to hold on to our profitability. So it is a huge and dramatic about face from really what has been American foreign policy for, nearly a century, a couple decades short of a century. So it's really quite significant what we're saying.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. If you want to follow Loud and Clear on Twitter, we're at Loud Clear Radio. You can also find us on Facebook, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. Daniel, staying on this topic of the sanctions imposed on ZTE by the United States, every economic policy, there are winners and losers, both, among ordinary people, but also at the heights of the economic elite. Thinking about the companies that do business with ZTE and the capitalists who do business with ZTE, do you think that they're going to be happy because, maybe this is eliminating or hobbling a potential competitor in the same market? Or do you see sort of an anti-sanctions lobby forming by companies who might feel that, they have profitable business dealings with this entity?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one thing that has made Trump so widely unpopular in a lot of the heights of the kind of ruling class, the sort of billionaires that determine this policy, is that Trump is really ineffective at managing all these complicated and conflicting needs and demands of ruling class elements. So he's not doing a good job kind of getting everyone to sort of work together to have some people give, some people take in exchange for something else, and negotiating this kind of complicated dance. So, for example, sanctions are a real pain for certain types of institutions, for example, financial institutions. They are not allowed to transact with these countries. They're not allowed funds to move to these countries. They're not allowed to open accounts or do business with particular people that are designated by the U.S. state to be blackballed, essentially, from the financial system. And it's an incredibly heavy lift. It's very hard to do, and it's very expensive. And so a lot of time, financial institutions really don't like it. It's this big regulatory regime that costs them money. But on the flip side, there are manufacturers that really benefit from these sort of things, and certain countries being locked out, as in this case. So certain manufacturers that depend on inputs from ZTC are going to be pretty unhappy because they're going to have to seek it elsewhere from companies that now that don't have to compete with ZTC. But then additionally, domestic producers here that have had to compete with ZTC and couldn't, right? It's extremely challenging to do business with a foreign company like that, are now going to be very excited. And so they're going to be able to jump in the market. The problem is that Trump is continually choosing a very specific part of the manufacturing kind of ruling class, this group of people that maybe had their heyday back in the 50s and 60s when manufacturing was king in the US and really have declined since then. And he's really choosing their interest over all these other interests of very powerful, wealthy interests in the tech industry, interest in the financial services industry, and not balancing their needs out at all. And so that's why there's a tremendous amount of animosity to him from the kind of very high elites in the world. And that's what we're seeing now, is he's really just favoring one very kind of small, particular fading class over all the others.
Daniel Sankey, let's go on with that theme just a little bit. Is it really Trump who's doing this, or is it a broader array of economic policy planners and advisors who are doing it? Does it constitute an empirical, or not empirical, an ephemeral sort of shift in U.S. policy, or is this something long-term? Again, I want to go back to the New York Times article. In a call with reporters on Monday, a senior Commerce Department official said the action against ZTE that would bar it from doing business for at least 7 years, said that the action was not connected to a broader intellectual property investigation into China. But the tough restrictions on ZTE may be perceived as a new salvo in a deepening economic conflict between the United States and China, as the Trump administration and the Chinese government trade threats of increased tariffs on everything from washing machines to soybeans. China's obviously being prudent and being very targeted in terms of their retaliatory sanctions. They're trying to hit, for instance, that part of agribusiness that's located in states that voted for Trump. But will this descend or devolve into an open, sort of broader, unmanaged trade war? Or do both sides kind of know what they're doing? It's a bit of shadow boxing. Anyway, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but how do you perceive it?
I think that the Trump administration and kind of those, bureaucrats and ideologues that support it very much want to see this war escalate and maybe even go so far as to become a hot war. You know, Steve Bannon was very clear about that. He said that, you know, if we don't do something about China in the next decade, that we're going to, you know, get in a lot of trouble and we need to do it now. So they want to see an escalation. They want to see an increased confrontation, whether economic or maybe even spilling out into military. China doesn't want that, right? You know, that would be a huge blow to China, a huge waste of resources and wealth to engage in this war with the United States. So they're going to do everything they can to back it off. The question is, are those ideologues and Trump's supporters able to kind of maintain power long enough? I think China, you know, it's a country that's been around for thousands of years, is thinking the long game. And they're looking at Trump and they're looking at his administration and they're saying to themselves, you know, I don't think this has staying power. I don't think this is going to last. I think this is going to get swept in the next election, or, you know, different elements within the United States are going to take care of it. So I think they're going to be very circumspect and very patient. That being said, you know, trade wars have a way of descending into hot wars. And if Trump was able to get really aggressive and really back China against a wall to where they'd be forced to kind of retaliate and defend their interests, they may do that. But I think they're going to be the kind of adults in the room and they're going to wait it out and see. You know, 4 years dealing with Trump, they can do that. You know, they've been around for thousands, like I've said. I think they're just playing the long game and assuming that he's probably not long for the world.
When Donald Trump and Shinzo Abe meet later today, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to be on the agenda. We're going to be talking with Vijay Prashad a little bit later in the episode about that. But I wanted to get your thoughts on it, too, since we're talking about the U.S. economic policy and strategy and how it's, you know, targeted towards containing the economic and political rise of China. You know, Donald Trump made such a big deal about the TPP on the 2016 campaign trail that, you know, we could see why he felt politically compelled to, you know, trash the deal shortly after taking office. But really, I mean, when you think about the strategic interests of the elite in the United States, it's the TPP is kind of like a no-brainer, right, when it comes to containing China and creating sort of a parallel economic belt to compete with China's strategy. What do you think about that? I mean, will the TPP be revived? Again, the crystal ball doesn't exist, of course.
The TPP is revived.
Yeah.
It never stopped. It didn't even
revive.
Will the
U.S. rejoin?
Will the U.S. rejoin? Yeah. That's what obstacles will it have to overcome?
That's a really important question. So the first time the TPP failed, right, which happened, you know, while Trump was on the campaign trail and he kind of put the end to it, that was due to huge public outcry and grassroots movements in the streets against the TPP and against the sort of really just a bill of rights for corporations and investors. And there was a huge grassroots pushback against it. It became incredibly unpopular. And more the politicians became aware of the fact that this was not something that was supported by their people. And so they backed off. Trump, you know, it was dead. Trump just kind of sealed the coffin shut. He didn't do anything particularly dramatic. Now, that doesn't mean the corporations are going to give up. They are going to be patient. They're going to be strategic, and they're going to keep pushing and pushing. This is the next phase in that, is them saying, well, maybe we can get the TPP moved through now. You know, maybe there was a year delay, but no big deal. We'll get it pushed through, which is why we're seeing these new conversations about the TPP. And maybe they can get Trump to sort of opportunistically say, oh, I renegotiated it, and now it's great for workers, and it's going to make America great again, and it's a good deal. Because, of course, you know, he wants to pass himself off as some kind of savvy business person that can make these amazing deals for the U.S. It's certainly possible, and the corporations are going to push hard to make it happen. They have the army of lobbyists, the army of lawyers that are very good at these things. The question is, will the people stand up and cry out again? The TPP didn't die that long ago, so it's still fresh in the minds of people who care about it, and I could see mobilization starting again around it. That being said, if they don't, it's pretty likely that the U.S. will re-enter it, basically in the same form that it would have had they entered it the first time, maybe some minor tweaks, but nothing substantial. So really it's up to people organizing and getting out in the streets and voicing their opinions and demanding that there not be this special bill of rights for investors. If that happens, then it will get killed again.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. He joins Loud and Clear every Tuesday. Every Tuesday between 4 and 5 p.m. to talk about the big economic issues of the day, how they affect America, how they affect the world economy. Right now, Daniel, because we've been focusing on U.S.-China economic relations, trade relations, and also the big picture of how they might affect the United States' position in the global marketplace and also in global politics, I want to stay with it if we can. We don't have that much longer, but I want to go back to what the Chinese reaction is. We've been talking about why the U.S. and why the Trump administration with different factions within the U.S. elites are taking this position, this hardline position towards China. Again, we were talking about the ZTE Corporation. I'm just looking at some of the Chinese media, and I want to go back to it and read a couple sentences and then get your reaction. And Walter, if you have a feeling about this too, this is from Global Times, a Chinese publication. The U.S. Commerce Department on Monday banned American companies from selling components to China's telecommunication gear maker ZTE. And then it goes on about how negatively this has affected ZTE. Its stocks have tumbled. I mean, it's really, you know, it's been a big blow to the company. But then later in the article, the editorial writers say these words: China has never questioned the reliability of U.S. suppliers in the past, but ZTE's case suggests that the U.S. supply is not reliable. The global supply chain is fragile in the face of politics. Americans have started to reckon upon means to counter China's rise, and restraints on high-tech exports to China are their leverage. The U.S. may use this tool more widely in the future. China must prepare for the worst and integrate resources to support the development of core technologies. China's technological exploration shouldn't be upset by U.S. factors. It's time for China to make up its mind and develop domestic technologies. And what they're talking about in particular are advanced chip technologies, not just medium and low chip technologies. Talk about that, Daniel.
Yeah, I think that this is part of the sanction strategy backfiring, because one thing sanctions can do is cripple a country and ruin its economy. Another thing sanctions can do is make them more independent and force them to create domestic markets, which is obviously what that editor is advocating for in his article. China is far more technologically advanced than mainstream media gives them credit for. You know, they complain about the Great Firewall of China keeping out things like Facebook and Google. But what that's done is that's caused Chinese technologists there to develop their own incredible apps, incredible services that really do the same things, and keep the money out of the hands of U.S. companies and keep it within China. They have some incredible applications, technologies, smartphone technology. And what they're advocating for right now is growing that domestic market, saying, fine, we don't need to buy from you. We'll create them ourselves. We'll build them ourselves. China has technology to do it. You know, they have a heavily organized economy. It's not, you know, completely socialist, but it definitely has those strong characteristics. So it can pivot quickly, perhaps more quickly than normal capitalist economies. And that's what they're advocating for. If they start developing it, it may be that the sanctions will become, you know, kind of shadow boxing and worthless, and have the unintended result of making China more independent from U.S. economy, which would be a big blow to U.S. empire and a real strengthening of China.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I think that those are really interesting points. I mean, it also, I think, fits with the Chinese leadership's general thinking for how their economic development should progress. You know, there's this a concept in developmental economics called the middle income trap, where, you know, a country that is heavy on manufacturing and is a low income country, making the transition to a high income country that's primarily relying on the services industry is, you know, basically for a lot of different historical reasons, extremely difficult to do. And most countries get caught in, you know, the quote unquote middle income trap. And so, you know, the Chinese economy took off in terms of growth rates in, you know, the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, using, you know, relatively low-tech mass manufacturing of consumer goods that were relatively cheap. But the Chinese leadership has been saying for a long time that to move up the ladder in the global supply chain, they need to introduce more and more high-tech elements to mass production. And I think Germany is a model that a lot of the Chinese economic planners look to as, you know, an advanced high-income country that still has a significant manufacturing sector, but it's also highly profitable because so much advanced technology is incorporated into it. The other thing about the Chinese response to the sanctions, I mean, as after the latest Communist Party Congress and also the two sessions, the meeting of the country's legislative branch, the country's government's legislative branch, you know, the economic stability was at the very top of President Xi's priority lists. You know, there is a consolidation of regulatory bodies in China. There, you know, used to be like one regulatory body for the stock exchange, one for the insurance market, and I think one or two other regulatory bodies. Those have now, you know, all are in the process of being merged into one super body. Xi appointed one of his top aides to be the head of, you know, a central leading group on the economy. So I think that these types of threats, the financial stability of the country, are going to be taken extremely seriously by the leadership at this moment.
Go ahead, Daniel.
That's absolutely correct, especially the constant consolidation of the regulatory bodies is particularly interesting. I mean, in the U.S., regulatory bodies are so decentralized and often at odds with one another, conflicting with one another, and not able to kind of see the big picture of how all the different industries impact one another. Consolidating that presumably would show a lot better knowledge sharing between those groups and ability to manage economy as a whole rather than just little aspects of it, which are not separate but integrated into the rest of the economy. I think this does fit in with China's overall strategy. You know, Xi has been very clear that he wants to see this huge growth in globalization, this connecting China to the larger global market, to not just being dependent on the U.S. and the West. And China's strategy is very different from the West. They very much believe in a kind of quid pro quo, where they'll come into other countries and say, look, you know, we'd like to open factories here, but in exchange, we'll build you roads, or in exchange, we'll give you favorable trade deals, or something, where the country actually materially benefits and profits and grows because of Chinese influence there. This to be compared, of course, with the United States, where, for example, in the Middle East, if we want their oil, we'll engage in military actions that have very little to no benefit to the people there and you know, decimate countries so that we can take the resources. China's playing the long game, and they're building those relationships with people in Africa. They're building those relationships with different countries across the globe and growing their influence there where they're really benefiting them. And countries are listening and perking up. And especially under an administration with Donald Trump, which is so disgusting, unpopular, unpredictable, irrational, these other countries are not seeing U.S. as this kind of, you know, be-all, end-all of the country that they should do business with.
We run out of time again. That was Daniel Sankey. To understand politics, you have to understand economics. And we have Daniel Sankey as a special segment to discuss economic issues on Loud and Clear every Tuesday. So check us out every Tuesday. You can follow us at Loud Clear Radio and also Loud and Clear with Brian Becker on Facebook. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.